or download an app on your phone and bring that to 2 Peter. That would be great. The first thing that I immediately like about our new auditorium here is the fact that there's no clock on any wall. So we go until I look at my phone and realize that we've gone over time. And then we'll start to wrap it up. Just so folks know, this is what they call a document camera. I'm going to use it here in a little bit. It takes a picture of what's directly underneath it. And it's going to put it up on the screens. We're probably only going to use it mainly during class time, and that's not the final form of it. We want to get a better table for it so it's not such in the way. But it's a tool that's going to help us teach. As many of you remember, I lived and died by a whiteboard in our own in our old building. And this will function kind of like a portable whiteboard. Aaron, would you put off the document camera, please, for a second, HDMI 2? So he'll put this up, and then I'll show you what it looks like, and then we probably can leave it up. So you can zoom. I'll zoom in at some point because there's a section I want us to look at. Actually, right there, refocus it. And that's actually going to be the main thing that we look at today on the lesson. But that's the purpose of it. Saves me a lot of writing. How many remember that you couldn't read my writing anyway? Okay, so there's a lot of hands going up. So there's some memories from the old building that we want to do without. So when I can type something like this and put it up. So that's what that's for. Ideally, it's going to be more over here, a little bit lower to the ground. But that's what that's about. And I'm excited. I think that these TVs are going to help us with the teaching. To try to help bring some focus to that. I appreciate Dave leading us in singing this morning. Cliff, beautiful prayer, very focused on that. Thank you. I appreciate everybody that has kind of labored with us in this process. We talked about this in our prayer meeting this morning, that the church here has been around for 50 years. And so even though it feels like it's a new beginning for us, it's still a continuation of what folks like Wally and Julia started. And it's a new phase. It's not a new beginning for us, but it's a new phase. And we can bring glory to God by focusing on what he blessed us with here and trying to use that in a way that will reach out and impact others. Here's the other cool thing. If I was writing in real time, you could see that too. So I might be more excited about this than you guys are. Time will tell on that. But we're in 2 Peter. And last week, we read the chapter. Again, one of the features from the old building that I continued into our time at the school was taking forever to teach through passages. So last week, we covered 3 verses. But that's nothing new for you guys, right? Because sometimes we go in depth, sometimes we don't. But last week, we looked at verses 1, 2, and 3. And one of my points was that in 2 Peter 2, Peter kind of goes on a rant about the false teachers. And in that section, I counted at least 13 things that he says about the false teachers, about them. You might remember that I made a distinction between what Peter says about the teaching of the false teachers versus what Peter says about the false teachers themselves. And I was surprised that because we're always told don't speak ill of a person, don't say anything negative about a person, that Peter is quite negative about the false teachers. He lists at least 13 problems that he has with them. Now, that's not because Peter's ungodly and because Peter's not trying to be a good Christian. One of his points is he needs to make sure that the folks he's writing to understand very clearly the destructive tendency of the teaching of the false teachers. So we might read it as Peter being very critical about the false teachers, but what Peter is trying to do is to say, look, these guys are not good guys. These are not the kind of men that you want teaching when you come to church. These are the kind of men that you need to actually stay away from. And so we spent time in chapter 1 last week in verses 1, 2, and 3 looking at 5 or 6 things that Peter says about the false teachers right there in that first paragraph. I think sometimes when we read the Bible, that's irrelevant. Can we just shut this off for a second, Aaron? Thanks. One of the things when we read the Bible, I think that we tend to project. I know we do this sometimes when it comes to the disciples. You know, the disciples are out there most of the time in the Gospels making a fool out of themselves, right? They're out there misunderstanding what Jesus said. They're out there rashly getting ahead of what Jesus is trying to do. Jesus has to rein them back in. And our tendency is to look at them and say, well, how in the world could they not get this straight? How could they not figure out? Jesus is right there in front of them. How could they not figure out what Jesus is trying to get at? And we position ourselves against them by saying, well, if we were one of the disciples, we would have done better. And I think it's the same way with what Peter's writing here. We read chapter 2, and in chapter 2, Peter is scathing towards these false teachers. But what we need to remember is that if we were undergoing some of this false teaching, we would probably be susceptible towards it. It's like, how many when you were in school had a teacher that you just adored? There's one or two teachers that you still recall them, in some cases decades later, because they were influential. They taught you well. Maybe they took a special interest in you. Maybe they, I don't know, that for whatever reason you connected with that teacher. Now imagine if that teacher said something that didn't sound right to you, you would probably be willing to at least consider it versus somebody that came in, a substitute teacher walks in and says the identical thing, and you're like, that's not the case, that can't be right. But because the teacher that you're connected with or connected to says it, you're probably more inclined to believe it. And I think that's what Peter's dealing with here. Peter's dealing with Christians who are wrapped up with the personalities of these teachers that are coming in and teaching false things, to the point that they're becoming susceptible about the teaching because they like the teachers. So they're slipping or sliding into this false because the teacher is popular among them. So Peter has to kind of go back to the beginning and raise all sorts of issues about the false teachers to tell the Christians, wake up. Wake up, guys. Because they're in danger, the Christians are, of falling themselves. We read chapter 2 last week. At the end of chapter 2, we have these couple of sayings that Peter is saying about the false teachers. He says of them, the Proverbs are true. Verse 22, a dog returns to its vomit, and a sow that is washed returns to her wallowing in the mud. Now, Peter's saying that about the false teachers, but he's using them as a warning. He's telling them, if the guys that are popular in your midst are up teaching and they've kind of lost their way, if you follow them, what's the outcome of your following of them? You're going to lose your way too. So chapter 2, we need to understand not so much as a condemnation of the false teachers, even though it's that, as it is a warning to the believers to make sure that they're walking on the right path. This is why he started chapter 1 the way that he did. Do you remember when I taught chapter 1, I said that one of the things that he's trying to do here is reground them in the gospel and in the pathway towards spiritual growth. And he's doing that because of this ridiculous level of false teaching that was trying to be brought in. Why didn't he start the other way around? It's because he's regrounding them as part of that wake-up call. So he refocuses them on what the gospel is and then says those who aren't teaching that need to be cast aside. They just need to be let go of. Does that make sense? We can take questions in this class still. I know it's different, but we can still take questions. So now we come to chapter 2, verses 4 through 9. Aaron, let's put the camera back on, please. And this is the chart that I've got here is what I'm going to put up, which is kind of, it's the summary of this. Let's not worry about the difficulties right now. Okay. So in chapter 2, verses 4 through 9, Peter is going to contrast some scriptural examples, and he's got one simple point. If God could send those people to judgment but still protect the ones who were righteous, then it's going to be the same for you. You don't have to fear. You don't have to worry. Yes, there were some bad influences. You can kind of kick them to the curb, and God's going to protect you. Well, how do we know that? How do we know? Because Peter says, and we see it over and over and over again in the Bible. I'm going to give you three examples. Remember at the end of chapter 1, Peter talked about the reliable prophetic word. Well, now he's going to go to that reliable prophetic word to show them, I'm not making this up. Remember he said in chapter 1, I'm not making up what I tell you. Those guys are, but I'm not. Because I was an eyewitness of things, of Jesus, and I have the reliable prophetic word that I can draw from. And so now he goes to that reliable prophetic word to show them that, in fact, what he's saying is not made up. It's true that God is able to save and protect those who are in the midst of a lot of unrighteousness. Because that's their problem, isn't it? We read chapter 2, and it's almost like you'd imagine someone in the rows here, and then there's false teaching here and here and here, and they're surrounded by it, and they're hearing Peter's letter, and they're saying, yeah, that's right. Yeah, this got messed up in a hurry. I can see where those guys are wrong, but I don't know what to do because I feel surrounded by it. And Peter's going to say, don't worry about that, because in the Bible, there were folks that were surrounded by unrighteousness whom God protected. And so he's going to give three examples. Now, this is also one of the sections in chapter 2 where I said, guys who study the Bible for a career, like in universities, who have time, they're paid to do nothing but research and write books, don't understand some of what's happening in chapter 2. So, and that's where I'm saying I'm not wasting time arguing about some of these things that we're going to read about in verses 4 through 9. Because Peter's point is simple and clear. In the middle of unrighteousness, God can protect you. That's his point, which I find, frankly, very comforting. Don't you? Aren't we worried sometimes? Like we hear another news report about some school shooting or some riot that's happening somewhere, or concern about war with North Korea or something, or even in our case, you know, we kept hearing that the building is going to be ready for months and months and months, and it kept getting pushed back, and we're like, seriously, when? But in the middle of all that chaos, Peter's message is, God will protect you. In fact, God is protecting you. So we need to read a letter like this and not get hung up on, well, what did he mean when he talked about, or what's going on with these angels, or what's the blasphemy that's heaped upon the celestial beings? Who are those celestial beings? How is Lot described as righteous? Who are these people? Who are these angels that weren't spared? That's not Peter's point. Peter's point is, all throughout history, God's people have been surrounded by wickedness and unrighteousness, but God has always protected them. And we know that if we went back to the Old Testament. Now, Peter doesn't directly get into this, but if you go back and think about the promise that God made to Abraham and how many centuries passed between that promise to Abraham and the birth of Jesus that fulfilled that promise, centuries that God protected his people. And he still does. So let me read verses 4 through 9. Wait, I'm supposed to be done 10:30 today, right? Okay, good, I've got time. Today might be the only day ever that I'm going to end on time. Just FYI. I try to end on time. There's no church bells to warn me that our time is up. And we did not install a chime, huh? Dave can make church bells for us. But I'm going to wrap up on time today. And then my commitment that I made a few months ago in the school was a commitment to start on time. I'm not doing Otisville time anymore when it comes to Bible class. I'm starting on time, but I will not commit to ending on time. Okay, verses 4 through 9. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes and made them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued Lot, a righteous man who was distressed by the depraved conduct of the lawless, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard, if this is so, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to hold the unrighteous for punishment on the day of judgment. This is especially true of those who follow the corrupt desire of the flesh and despise authority. So what's Peter talking about? Well, he's got one simple point, and that one simple point is verse 9. Everything that comes before verse 9 and verses 4 through 8 is him building support for why verse 9 is true. Okay, so in verse 4, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, what's he talking about? I'm saying that's not important to what Peter's point is. We don't have to identify who those angels are. Now, I have my own idea about who those angels are, but it's not going to affect the interpretation. Peter's simply saying there were some angels who sinned, and God cast them over for judgment. So Peter's point is, God, there were some heavenly beings with God, and they sinned. Now, I think he's talking about they sinned so as to fall. I think he's talking about that for sure. But God did not give them a pass because he said, well, they're with me, so that's fine. I'll just overlook this. God said, I'm putting them in hell to reserve them for judgment. And Peter's using that as a support to say, if God's going to do that with the heavenly beings that were with him, then we can be sure that he's going to handle these guys over here. He said, and you can see, if you look at the chart here, that this is the way Peter develops this section. So he starts out on the one hand by saying, if God did not spare, and then he gives a few examples, but he did do this, and then he counters those examples with what God, with how God held some for judgment, with how God protected his people, and then that's going to build to his point, which is, if these things are so, if we believe what God said or what God did in those Old Testament examples, then the conclusion is, from Scripture, that the Lord knows how to rescue and protect the godly. He knows how to do this. Is it anything new for us to be in the middle of chaos and wonder if God's going to be able to protect us? No. Why? Because he's done it over and over and over and over and over again through his history. This is why it's good to know the Bible. We see how God acts consistently throughout history to save and protect his people. Maybe you feel like I'm belaboring the point. I don't think they would have felt that the point was being belabored. So he goes on. If God did not spare the angels who sinned, but sent them to hell for judgment. So that's the action of God and then the consequence that speaks in a positive way to the believers. If God did not spare the ancient world that was filled with ungodliness, but he protected Noah. And what's the hallmark of Noah that leads to his protection? He was righteous. And he mentions that same thing for Lot, doesn't he? Noah was righteous in verse 5. Lot was righteous in verse 7. I know some of us might quibble with the so-called righteousness of Lot. I think Peter is relying on Jewish tradition around some of the Old Testament passages to draw some of these points that we just don't have access to. But again, it's irrelevant for his point, because if God did not spare the angels who sinned, if God did not spare the ancient world filled with ungodliness, if God did not spare Sodom and Gomorrah, which in Genesis were pictured for us as the locations of unrighteousness, if God did not spare them, but in the case of the angels, he held them over for judgment. In the case of Noah, he was protected. In the case of Lot, he was rescued. So you see a couple of different things there, right? Noah was preserved in an ark. He was protected. Lot was taken out of Sodom and Gomorrah. He was rescued. And so Peter's writing to them and saying, if these things are so, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to hold the unrighteous for punishment on the day of judgment. And that's what we take from this, that we can have confidence in who God is, what his plan is, how he's working that out, and knowing that his track record is that he's going to protect and take care and rescue the righteous in the middle of their trials. So how does that help us? I can't tell you five ways of how this is going to help you, but what I can tell you is that this is the kind of thing, the kind of gospel message that takes root and changes us. Because when we're in the middle of a trial, we remember that God's track record is one of protection and rescuing. When our worlds feel like they're collapsing in on us, we remember what? God rescues and protects his people. When we feel like we don't know which way to turn because every time we've turned in a direction, it's not worked out for us, and we don't know what's happening, and we're getting tired of turning in directions and finding a wall in front of us every time, we think back to God who does what? He rescues and protects his people. Do you see how this section, it's not about the doctrine about who these angels are and how Lot could be righteous and teaching more about Noah. It's not about, and it's not even about the false teachers. This section is about us and whether or not we trust God to protect and rescue us. If our salvation is in God, then it stands that his protection and rescuing of us will also be there. And that should bring us comfort. I'm going to wrap up there. It's a few minutes early. Do not hold me to this in the future. I've enjoyed